Hello and welcome to the Tomorrow Brands podcast, where we explore what it takes to build a brand of tomorrow. I'm your host, Ruth Vitok, and today I'm chatting with Brody Meir, co-founder of Top Cuvée, the restaurant-turned-retail brand that made wine feel fun again. We get into how fine dining taught him to think like a founder, why natural wine isn't always the answer, and what happens when you build an e-com business with a hospitality mindset. Hope you enjoy.
Hi, Brody. Thanks for joining us today. And before we get into it, it'd be great to hear your background and how you got to where you are now.
Let's start from university days in Manchester. I ended up getting a job in a bar to pay the bills in uni, as we do, and absolutely loved it. Fell in love with the industry. And I went from working in like pretty crazy nightclubs to cocktail bars and then gradually getting slightly better venues around Manchester until I was working in some of the best restaurants in the city. That then took me to Melbourne. That's where two things happened. Got introduced to natural wine out there, and kind of opposite to that, we also started working in fine dining. So I worked for the British chef Heston Blumenthal in his restaurant over there called Dinner. So it's like a two Michelin star restaurant. It was like university for me, and that was really what taught me about obviously world-class hospitality and service, but also exposed me to a world-class business. That kind of equipped me with the skill set I needed in order to go out on my own, which is always what I've always wanted to do, even since a young age. Didn't know what it was I'd be doing. I always knew I wanted to work for myself. My wife and I moved back to the UK to open a restaurant. That restaurant was Top Cuvée.
What was your original vision for Top Cuvée?
The vision for Top Cuvée was to take this experience that I've had in fine dining, which was amazing, and on paper is all about showing people an amazing time. But the real experience that I had there were people were very intimidated by this kind of grand, flashy restaurant. Same with the wines there. They come in a leather-bound folder, purposely, like, none of it's in English. It's 17 different languages in there. Obviously, no one can understand all of that apart from the sommelier. So it's very good, high quality and amazing produce and stuff, and loads of effort has gone into that experience. But I just felt like the whole service side was quite anti-customer, wasn't very welcoming. So we wanted to open a restaurant that had the same level of attention to detail and care and really wanted to have a good time, but was just welcoming and accessible.
And a focus on natural wine, right?
Yeah, it was initially, but we feel again, so it's an interesting sort of side quest now. We found the natural wine scene was the answer to that stuffy hospitality kind of elitism. That's what we thought, right, when we started to get into all of that. And then that was the case. It was slightly more accessible, but then once you get into it, actually it's just the same. It's the same thing, but in a different uniform. So you've got on the one side fine dining sommeliers who are snooty by the old-fashioned way, but then it's exactly the same with these kind of hipsters wearing a Carhartt shirt, and we got to know the right chefs and this and that, and the winemakers. It's exactly the same. We thought natural wine would be a really good, like a touch point, like an anchor for people that they understand, like that terminology, like craft beer. But honestly, I feel it's more derisive because some people now, if you say natural wine, they're like, oh no, but that's like weird or funky. And the whole point is our wines are like clean and drinkable. A lot of natural wines are, but we found that it's a bit of a distraction.
And so you launched, lockdown hit. How long after launch?
So the restaurant opened and then it was pretty much exactly 1 year and then lockdown happened. So the interesting part about that, we just reached the point where I was like, oh, wow, like this restaurant's actually open. Like we have regulars, we can keep the lights on here. It was, could have been a very devastating time, but I think also it was a good time because we had all the energy. And we just reached the over the crest of creating our little community there around the restaurant. So that's nice. Why we were able to pivot like we did.
Yeah, so we'll talk about the pivot. You then launched Shop Cuvée in about 48 hours. How did you do that?
Incidentally, two of the chefs we were working with, Graziano and Cosimo, were our two guys working in the kitchen at the time. They were from Italy. So every service, we were looking at what was happening in Italy. And I don't know if you remember, but they were like a month or 2 weeks ahead on the kind of time scale of the virus. So it's almost like we had a little crystal ball that this thing was going to be pretty big. And obviously the media and the government at the time were downplaying it quite a bit. So we don't really know, just carry on. And we were like, no, this is going to be serious. Because we could see it all in Italy. On the first day when we shut the restaurant before lockdown was announced, and we just said, hey, we're shop. And my, yeah, it was, now we have shops. It wasn't a very good shop at the time, but it's a job. So we took all the wine out the back, put it on the tables in the front, and yeah, put the cutlery and stuff away. And that was the beginning of the shop.
Nice. How, and you do D2C as well, right? It was a D2C offer
too. Yeah, that came 2 days later because, funnily enough, when I was opening the restaurant, I was working as a bike courier to just pay the rent and keep working while we were renovating the restaurant. So just was like, oh, I know how to deliver things. We can do that. So at the time, like that immediate delivery thing wasn't massive. It was before GoPuff or any of those like immediate things existed. So that was a bit of a secret weapon that we had there. We were just, it was a vibe. It was pretty crazy times.
So speaking of vibe, how have you managed to keep the feel of the restaurant experience? You talk about your passion for hospitality into the shop experience.
Yeah, I think by doing what we do and being who we are. And I think when we first opened the retail side, that was a huge benefit for us. I feel like we just take it for granted. That's an interesting question for me to answer now that we've actually been in retail for so long. When you walk into a typical wine shop, the service is nothing memorable. Whereas when you come into one of our stores, we treat you just like like you walk into the restaurant. So it's, hey, how's it going? Strike up a conversation. And yeah, we have a sequence of service that we follow. So it's like your little steps of service all the way through a customer's experience. And we just replicated that, really. Obviously changed it a bit. We're not serving food in the shops, but yeah, I hope that answers that in a good way, because it's just, we just be ourselves and that's all we know how to do.
And what do you think working the floor did in shaping the wine range that you now stock?
I think what's important with that is we've actually listened to the customers. A lot of wine ranges that you see serving sommeliers and people who are like obsessed with the nuances of the wine trade. What we learned from our restaurant and from my time in hospitality is most people are not that interested in wine. It's like they just want something that tastes really good and is well made and also within their price range. So I think that's the biggest thing we took away from the floor is actually, yeah, we're creating this list for the customer, not for us. There's so many wine lists and wine shops that you see where they have these incredible selections, but is it a bit too much for the average customer? Yeah. If you're going for us, which is to, we want to serve everyone, the mainstream. I appreciate a lot of those stores are actually targeting wine collectors and stuff like that. And that's fine. But yeah, I think that's why we're so popular, really, is because we just keep it simple and make it approachable.
So we've talked a bit about this already, but how have you navigated that change from being a hospitality business to a product-based brand? What do you think you've done differently?
Oh my God. So that, I can tell you now, we've done it all backwards. So we've created, you know, the story, everything we've spoken about is true. That happened. We've started in hospitality and next thing, this, that, the other. So it's a brilliant story and it's all true. Now we're trying to tell that through our product range, which already existed as well, because we brought out products over the years just randomly. And now we're a bit more established and we're trying to sell these products and commercialize the offering, I suppose, is the way of saying it. That's really challenging to go backwards. So what I wish we would have done is had a brand master plan or some sort of deck that is cool. This is the plan. So therefore, this is what we're going to do to build that story out. Yeah, I think that's the inexperience. And coming from hospitality, you're like a problem solver and like just run and gun kind of thing, get stuff done. I think what I've learned is when you're doing like a brand project, way better to just take a seat, think things through, really plan it, map it, what you're trying to say, get all of your messaging really boxed off. Because like I said, even though ours is 100% genuine and true, it's not the easiest thing to get across to your customers if it's a bit muddy. Because for me, it makes perfect sense, and I'm sure it's probably coming across a little bit. I know everything that's happened, but what you really want to dial in on is like the key messaging. We're still working on it.
It's a work in progress. Speaking of the brand, what were your most important channels when you were starting out?
Firstly, build a brand. I think visual identity, we got lucky with us. That was always just a key part of the restaurant. Even before we had ideas of anything, it wasn't really planned, but I think I just had a natural kind of eye for it, and I just knew what was important. So consistency, colors, things like that. So that helped us at the start. And then when it comes to the key channels, it was like just anything direct at first. So email was huge for us for a long time, still is. And social media was a big part of what we did. But that was like, we call that a bit of a like soft channel, because we never tracked anything. We just did it. Email was the most important channel. And then where we're at now is wholesale. It's our independent partners. And like I said, we wouldn't be able to work with them without building up that direct-to-consumer base first. If I'm honest, that's fallen off quite a lot for us. Our website sales have reduced, but the overall revenue of the business is increasing year on year. So it's like part of the strategy now for us is, okay, we've built this brand. Actually, D2C, we're better off outsourcing that to our wholesale partners. And so we're at the beginning of that journey now. So what I would say is it was all about direct connection. So Instagram, email to get us known in the world. And now I'm happy to say we've reached a point where, yeah, that's cool, we keep it going, but we can get more traction down the wholesale path.
Nice. So is that like brand building through distribution? So starting to see Top Cuvée and nice independence.
Exactly, yeah. And then independence is 100% our focus now. We do have a couple of big customers, a few big deals like that we're working on right now, but we are focused on our small independent, like our peers, because that like just goes back to who we are. Like we are you. We know your pains and problems. And yeah, it's like, from a salesy perspective, it's like easy to sell into someone who you know their business like intimately, but just genuinely, it's like, we love hospitality. We like working with a small independent.
And where do you look to for inspiration?
That's a good question. Always like from other industries, just yeah, like everywhere. Fashion quite a lot, but not to try and make it fashionable. Just like how they promote things, what they do visually. Sometimes you see things that are trending. Obviously, fashion is, they're always one step ahead of the curve. Then the other one is like music. I think that's quite interesting how independent artists go about promoting themselves and their music, especially when it comes to social media and like guerrilla marketing stuff. I feel like there's some really interesting things you can see from up and coming like artists, because they're just so creative by definition. Similarly with fashion, some of the smaller, scrappier like streetwear brands, it's not something that like I'm into personally, but the way that they market what they do is incredible, and they have small budgets and they get outsized results by being super creative and thinking outside the box.
Yeah, I love that. You might have already just answered this question, but your tone on social, very distinctive. Where did that come from?
Initially, that's me. That's my personality coming out. So we now have this written down, right, as a bit of a guideline on how we talk and tone of voice. So yeah, that's like what we've done. And I no longer run the social media account, but hopefully it's like somewhat consistent, because we've taken the personality and systemized that rather than the other way around. So I think sometimes it's a strength to work like that, though, especially if you're close to the business and you're a founder and you're doing it, like, yeah, utilize your personality.
For sure. Yeah, no, and I think you've done the right thing. It's definitely where a lot of brands start, but then there comes a point where you've got to get it down on paper and it has to live and breathe on its own and not just be you, even where it originated from you, but then it becomes its own entity, which is probably quite a relief for you as well if you're not having to do all the social content anymore.
It's a relief, but it's hard work because now I have to manage a brilliant social media manager. And I will say the results are better now because it's a bit more commercial. You look at it a little bit more critically and actually, okay, yeah, we're paying for this, so it needs to do this. But yeah, it's not easy because you still have to manage it. So yeah.
Different problems.
Yeah.
So you talked a bit about how wine has been like a very traditionally serious, intimidating space. Why do you think humour cuts through so well in your category?
I think it's not what people are expecting. And you will know this. Any good marketing isn't really like selling direct. Hey, look at the product and check the product and check the wine. So I feel like for us, we use humour because it's a way to just be present and capture people's attention, but without shoving things down their throat. And then like any good marketer knows, if you make people feel good or make people laugh and softly associate your product with that, then they'll buy in the end anyway. So I think, yeah, we never really cynically thought about that actually, but that I think that's right. You can get people's attention because no one wants to see a picture of a bottle of wine on Instagram. But if you're doing like a funny TikTok trend or something, they'll watch it and then they're like, oh, that's that wine shop I know about. Maybe I'll buy some wine.
I guess no one else is doing it, right? So it's in other wine brands particularly.
Yeah, it's uniquely us. We never talk about wine really on our socials. So I think that says it all really. We're top cuvée. Yeah, we could do anything. We did a bike ride last week with hundreds of people that turned up and we like it that way. We like top cuvée to be more. Yes, we sell a lot of wine, but when you see the top cuvée brand, we want you to think about what the result of the product is, if that makes sense. So we want you to think about having a good time with your friends when you think about top cuvée, not necessarily about drinking wine.
You've obviously got a really strong community around the brand. How important do you think community has been to your growth?
Oh, it's absolutely essential. A restaurant is community at the end of the day. It's a place that people come day in, day out, and especially somewhere like ours, it's local, it's in the neighborhood. So when I was working the floor there, we'd have people coming in every Sunday, and they still come. And they're friends now with our team. So that's like the cornerstone of our business, and that's all we knew about. Then when it came to retail, same thing, local neighborhood shops where you're coming in, you're getting your weekly bottle of wine for the weekend, cook your pasta and have a nice time with the family. I think what we did is we took that community and tried to take it online during COVID, and that was huge for us. The big thing that we learned there was positivity. At the time, in our industry, everything was super negative. Oh my God, we need grants from the government. Oh, this is so bad. Whereas we took an oath on day one. We said no matter how bad it is, we're going to be positive and whatever. If they try and cancel us, then so be it. Of course, nobody did because it's positive messaging. So everyone likes that. And then that's how we really won online during that period, was because we were just putting out super positive vibes. Everything we did was a win. And then it resonated with people so much. And then we've stuck with that for sure. So now, like in our brand kind of guidelines, we are a positivity-based company. And yeah, that helps. And then that even runs through into like our community of internally with our teams and stuff. It's always about having a positive mindset and just, then the rest comes. If you think you're doing great and you just want to show people a good time, then it's going to be all right.
Nice. And do you think your community has influenced the brand's evolution?
Yeah, totally. We're obsessed with our customers. I know probably a lot of brands say that, but we just are because of my background in fine dining. It's two Michelin star approach to running an e-commerce business. Thing. But yeah, so that when we were really heavy on e-commerce, that was like a thing. If we had issues with fulfillment and stuff, we would be like, what would a Michelin star restaurant do? And that often would manifest in us like delivering like on the night, going on our bikes to someone's house to drop something off and just really going the next level. That is now ingrained throughout the business. That's how we operate. And that's one of our core values, is that everyone leaves happy. So that's just a non-negotiable in any interaction with top cuvée. And then in addition, it's just like listening to them. And it's like taking people's cues. We have the restaurant that allows us to get immediate feedback, especially like stuff for new products and trialing out different ways of serving wine, things like that, and pairings. And even if they don't tell us directly, because we do try to have conversations as much as possible and get information like that, but sometimes it's like the sales on the till. Oh, this product is clearly popular. What does that tell us? And then we let that guide our decisions. I think over time, now we're leaning more into that product-based thing. It's a bit of a longer lead time. So that method is, again, just from me being in hospitality or what was the bestseller last week. We'll do more of that. Obviously, when it comes to sourcing wines and designing labels, there's a bit more of a lead time. So we take our time a little bit more, but yeah, it's still the same method.
Yeah, I love that Michelin star approach, although that must be hard work.
It is, but that's why it's a competitive industry. And it's, yeah, that's the good thing that you learn from hospitality. If you're not smashing it every single service, then you're not going to be busy the next day. And that's really something to mention. If you're building a brand, like every single touch point, every single interaction that you have, like people remember it. Yeah, it was one of my first hospitality jobs ever. I can't remember. They really nailed this, but essentially it was like people just remember the last thing that happens. The classic example is you've had an amazing meal in a restaurant and then you ask for the bill and they forget and then it takes 10 minutes and it's, ugh. If realistically that's not a big deal, but you've been there, right? That is annoying. And then you leave there and that's how you remember the place. And I think that's something you should really take into your brand building mindset. Every time, every interaction that someone has with your brand is like a memory maker. And just, you need to make sure those are good memories because people remember it and they just won't shop with you again, or that's it. You get one chance.
Yeah. I feel like that's a nice segue onto merch, talking about brand touch points and putting loads of effort in. You guys have got some amazing merch. It's become kind of part of the brand's DNA. Talk us through a couple of your favorite bits and then what your like approach to merch is.
Favorite bits, probably the cooler boxes that we have. They're awesome. I think a lot of it, we have a bit of a like an industrial kind of vibe in the retail side of things and with the merch, and that comes down to like good quality materials. So like our tote bags, we get really thick cotton ones, and these coolers, they're like industrial standard ones, because that's like tying into, I found like people really like what professionals use, whether that's like a chef, it's, oh, which knives do the chefs buy, or what chopping board does the chef recommend, stuff like that. So we try to sometimes make it like a little nod to, yeah, like we're the professionals and you can have a little piece of that if you buy some of our merch. And the other favorite one was like we did like a wine tote, it was like a single bottle wine carrier, and it was made of neoprene, like a wetsuit. So yeah, that those are two favorites, the two that lost us the most money as well, incidentally. We do it all again though.
Nice. With your community, with your socials, have there been any moments or posts along the way that have surprised you in terms of response?
There's been a couple of, couple of trend videos that have hit a few million views just out of nowhere. So that, for me, was really surprising, because that was one came from our social media manager that was like, look, we're going to jump on these trends, they'll do well. I was like, it's a bit dead. Can we not come up with something original? And then they're the biggest post by far.
Did you see like value from that in real terms as well?
I'm going to be honest, not really, because a lot of those viewers were in America. So yeah, it pumped up our numbers, which is not bad. That is good to get your account like active. But yeah, from a pure like brand building commercial perspective, not really. It's good for our egos.
This is what I think, everyone wants to go viral, although people have thankfully stopped putting into briefs now to agencies, I think, in the same way it was happening a while ago. But actually, once you hit a certain number, like to your point, unlikely those are going to be the people you actually want to speak to. And I've seen it before in brands, especially on TikTok, you can rack up some crazy numbers, but actually it's nice and you can use them and tell people that's happened, but it doesn't do much to shift things.
Not at all, no. But what we've done, Josh, who works for us, the commercial managers. He really like analytically thought about it and said, what we should have is like a system where we're aiming to get these big numbers, but then also we're serving our community as well. So we try and we put out these viral kind of style videos, but then we also make sure that we're making a bunch of content that's for our community and for our people. And the idea is we'll slowly grow the audience and then serve them with valuable content along the way. And that's really working well for us. You have to have both of those things working in your account in order to grow and serve your audience.
So we've talked about your hospitality values and how ingrained they are in the brand and how important they've been to building the brand. How do you think you'll hold on to those as you scale?
Yeah, it's good. I think we've simplified them into one key message, is wine for everyone. So any question, any decision that we have, it's like, does this make wine more accessible? Does this make wine fun? Yeah, that's the goal. That's the idea. We've written a little strap line. So it's top cuvée, wine for everyone. Most people find wine intimidating. So we've built a welcoming community, making great wine accessible to everyone so you can focus on having a good time with your friends. And that's our mission. And that's what we want to do. And it's important to remind ourselves of that regularly. And every meeting, we talk about that, and everything that we do, we run it through our core values. And I know a lot of people would have heard about that, the importance of values in your business. And when you're small, it seems a bit excessive. But honestly, it's taken us, this is our second iteration of this. The values have always been the same, to be honest, and the values exist, right? Whether you've got them written down or not, you have them. They're a really useful tool that help with your decision making. And then especially when you're bringing in other people, have a question or trying to make decisions, does it run through these four things? If so, then chances are we'll do it. That's super, super helpful. And we use them all the time, and like even with like random stuff. Like some of our designers, labels and stuff, we say, hey, just by the way, these are our company values. So get them in the right headspace for any kind of project.
Nice. No more hand delivering bottles on your bike, though.
We still do a bit of that. We just had a conversation, though. It's probably not cost effective anymore. We like it because of the eco side of things. That's really probably important to mention, like it's something that's been a big part of our business, is done so many last mile delivery by bicycle courier. Yeah, just with the way it's gone now, single bottles, it works really well. But yeah, it's, we'd still do it, but it's just a killer sometimes. You get a wholesale order and it's
you'd be out on your bike with 10 neoprene little bags.
Yeah, fortunately we have cargo bikes now, but yeah. Like I said, I was a bike courier for a while, so I'm like, yeah, you can do it. But you put in on a few hundred bottles of wine onto a bike, it's not the best.
It's heavy. Is there a moment where you'll feel like we've made it?
I think we've, yeah, I don't know. It's hard to answer that because I feel like we've already made it. I never would have thought we'd be doing this. So in one sense, we've already made it. But then in the other, yeah, we'll never get there because it's just a treadmill of like constant improvement. And no matter how many people we can touch, there's always going to be more. And yeah, the sky's really is the limit. And I think that's super important when you're trying to build something, because if we just set an endpoint, yeah, cool. And then what you get there and that's it. But reality, I think you need to just think massive, bigger than you're ever probably going to reach. But as long as you're thinking that far ahead, that's what's going to keep you going. I think we've got it written down somewhere. It's like £100 million turnover, this and that. And it's, yeah, that might get us to 10 million. And that's cool. I think that's important. And then we do have a bit more of a scaled down realistic approach as well, where we do quarterly, annual and 3 and 5 year targets. And just to try and bring us back down to earth a bit. But yeah, I feel like, yeah, it's a weird one because we do so much. We have the restaurants. There's always so much happening. We're busy and people are always happy and there's things happening. And so it's not like we need to get that listing and then we're sorted. We're there. So it's almost in our own hands to just see what comes and make the most of it.
What a great place to be.
Yeah.
So final question that we ask everyone. In your opinion, what makes a brand of tomorrow?
I think it's someone who's got a plan and someone who's customer focused. You know, that it, yeah, I think that's my answer. What makes a brand of tomorrow is your customers, for sure. So as long as you're serving them, they'll be good to you. And you've got to have your wits about you, because sometimes maybe customers don't know what they want just yet, but you've got to know, and you've got to be able to listen to them and read the room. And then, yeah, providing you look after them and they have a good product, good service, listen to your customers, then you'll have a strong brand for years to come. It's not about the logo and the website or anything like that. It's about your community and how you serve them.
Nice. Thanks so much for coming on, Brody.
My pleasure.